of the United States. And I must mention also that I was in, I trained also in terms of the national security, which is the Executive National Security Program that was undertaken through the department, the Defense Force, I mean, in the Defense College. This is a program where I specialized with the issues of national security. I also trained in, academically, I, at the moment, pursuing a master's degree in Master in Business Leadership. I also have a highest qualification, which is the honors degree in international politics. I also have a BA in political science through UNISA. I have a certificate with VETS on defense and security management. I have various certificates in management, also in ethics and governance. I have worked in the during amalgamation, because I have stated already that I was in the intelligence of the ANC in exile, but when we came back, I amalgamated in the South African Secret Service, where I served as a section head of vetting. Actually, I must mention that in that period, this is when I belonged to a junior working group together with the generals of the defense intelligence, also with the chiefs of the crime intelligence, to come up with inputs into the vetting legislation of the country as we were starting anew. I rose up from being a section head of vetting in SARS. I was a coordinator in the regions where I was responsible for intelligence. I also served as a country manager for counterintelligence in other regions as well. I moved to be a manager in corporate, in the defense counterintelligence wing of the service. After that, I left the intelligence community. I joined the South African Revenue Service. This is where I became a senior manager that was responsible for, they termed it national security. It actually is not national security, what I was responsible for. I was responsible for mainly personnel security and physical security. Amongst the tasks that I was doing, I was responsible for the vetting of members, something like more than 15,000 members of the SARS. I was also responsible for physical security in the sites of SARS all over the country, because I belonged to a unit that was called anti-corruption and security, but my role was more on the security side. I later moved from that unit to be in the unit that was specifically responsible for ethics and integrity of the revenue service. This is where my responsibilities were mostly inculcating the organizational culture that is based on the values of the organization, and also capacitating leadership so that they become leaders who have integrity and who also perform at their peak. That I was doing to the members generally and also to the leadership. I moved from SARS and I was at AMSCO, responsible for personnel security, which was mostly in terms of...
I don't want to cut you short. You are still going to give us your vision and you only have 10 minutes.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Then I went to AMSCO. I was doing vetting. I was interacting with the generals of the defense intelligence on matters of vetting, because AMSCO is doing vetting on behalf of the defense intelligence. And then later on, I was the special advisor to the Minister of Intelligence. At the moment, I am unemployed. I am at home. In terms of my vision for the Office of the Inspector General, I do believe that at the moment, we need to recognize that intelligence services, the way they are, the high-level review panel has already pronounced on that. The Zondo Commission's revelations that we have heard already pronounced on that. So these are ailing organizations. So my view is that when we start to do the issue of inspections and carrying out the function of the Inspector General, we have to take into account that we have an ailing organization or a sinking ship. So what we ought to do, we have to come up with strategies that will keep this ship afloat, that will ensure that this patient that we have is actually well. So what are the strategies that I have? I believe that the IGI's work needs to be proactive in nature, because to actually come after the fact when malfeasance has already happened is not cost-effective, is wasting the monies and the resources of the state. So what we need to do in terms of being proactive as the Office of the IGI, we need to have a capacity for threat and risk assessments, because in this way, we are able to say, in terms of crime intelligence, what are the threats that make crime intelligence not to perform the way it was for the way it was supposed, it was created to. We look at the SSA and ask the same questions. We identify those threats, and we see how they can manifest themselves, and we're able, therefore, to come with mitigation measures. So in terms of the inspection that happens between, which is done by the IG, I believe that there has to be a process of first sitting down with the heads of the intelligence services to say, here is the scope. Let us agree from the beginning, because we have already done the threat and risk assessment. We have already identified where are the threats going to emanate. So sitting down with the heads of the intelligence services is to say, these are the areas that we are going to inspect you on. And in that inspection, I don't believe that we should do the inspection only annually. I believe that inspection is supposed to be an ongoing process, and even the feedback to the intelligence heads is supposed to be at least on a quarterly basis. That will assist in terms of identifying those vulnerabilities and dealing with them as the time permits at that point in time, not to wait to come with remedial actions when actually damage has already been done. And I take note of the fact that to be able to do that, you need to build a good relationship with these heads of intelligence services. They need to understand that I am not just coming, as the media would want to call the Inspector General, as a watchdog. Because when they see me as a watchdog, already they have a resistance towards me. So they have to see me as a part and parcel of coming up with strategies and solutions so that their organizations can be effective and efficient. I do believe...
2 minutes.
I do believe that you cannot do that without having a very strong capability and capacity of counterintelligence within the Office of the Intelligence Inspector General. Because if you do not have counterintelligence, you are going to miss all these other points. That is why you are going to work on a reactive mode, which is counterproductive. I believe that you have to have a strong system where you are able to have a case management system that will be able to, because what I have realized as working as a chairperson of the appeal and adjudication board in the ministry when I was still there, was that people have a perception that the IGI is selective in handling cases. Some people's cases are handled, some are not. So I believe that there needs to be a case management system that will be able to prioritize cases according to their risk level, and also to build in a mechanism for feedback, because another outcry is that people do not get feedback from the Inspector General. I think also immediately is to say we do also need to have a capacity for advocacy. Or not just the members of the service have to know about the existence of the Inspector General, but the public out there have to know about the existence and how the Inspector General is serving them in order to ensure that this democracy that we are talking about is actually alive and they can be participants to it. If I still have time, I can continue, Chairperson.
I don't think so, but what is going to happen is some of the things that you still have to say will come from when you answer questions from the members. Your mic. Can I start with Honorable Dlagude today?
Yeah, it's Christmas for me today because the chairperson is starting with me. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Ms. Lamini, good morning.
Good morning, ma'am.
Yeah, I can hear that you have expressed yourself well. You have you understand why you are here. Ms. Lamini, Section 14, subsection 1, A and B of the powers, privileges, and immunities of Parliament and provincial legislatures provides for a joint committee to invite any person to appear before it under oath or affirmation to give evidence or produce documents that or an information that might be needed. Then what is your understanding of Section 14 of the Act that I've already quoted with regard to the certificates and information that the IGI produce annually? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Member. My understanding of that section is that the Inspector General of Intelligence is given powers to be able to access intelligence documents and to access any information, even premises, within these intelligence services in order for the Inspector General to be able to do his work of inspection. Because without having these powers, the Inspector General will not be able to fulfill the mandate that the Act, the Oversight Act, is giving him to be able to do. So these are the powers that the Inspector General, as the oversight body of this country, is given. Now, we know very well as well that in terms of how the systems are working, it all depends on whether the intelligence heads are willing to give the Inspector General the information, the documents, and even allow him to enter the premises. But I want to believe that there needs to be a change when it comes to that part. I think there has to be a situation where the Inspector General even has her own ITC system, where from the premises of the Inspector General, they can be able to access documents the way they want. They have to have that unfettered access in terms of acquiring intelligence documents from the, not just to rely on the willingness of the heads of the intelligence services.
Thank you very much for that response through you, Chairperson. Madam Lamine, you've been moving from one job to the next. What were the reasons for that? If you can elaborate on that one. Thanks.
Thank you, ma'am. I don't know whether to address ma'am or honorable member. How should I?
I think it's fine. You can juggle them around. It's still fine.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Yes, Honorable Zagut, I really believe that, you know, when I was in intelligence at that time, as I have already made my account into when I started and so on, the time came when I believed and realized that, you know, when you are in intelligence, it's like you are in a cocoon. You are protected because remember also you can't talk about your job and share what you are doing with anybody else. So at times it makes you to be stifled and to have wachtlape, like you are not aware of what is happening around you in terms of other departments. And so I found for myself that it will be important for me that even though I do believe, because I'm passionate about intelligence, I know intelligence is my home, but I need to venture out so that I see what other people are doing and how is it that I can contribute there. What is it that I can learn to expand my knowledge so that even wherever I am able to do that. And if you can check, ma'am, you will see that wherever I was doing work that will be intelligence related, but also it gave me an opportunity to learn about other organizations and how other organization functions. This is why I am able then to sit down even when I'm there and to say, but things are not working the way they are supposed to work, because I have tasted and I have seen how other very healthy organizations function. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Minister, your Chairperson. The high-level panel report agreed with the 2006 Task Team report on the review of intelligence-related legislations and regulation, and also the 2008 Matthew Commission report that said that the Office of the Inspector General on Intelligence must be given this independent status from the SSA with its own administration and budget. Then what is your view in this regard? And if appointed for the next 5 years, what would you do to ensure that this office attain that independent status?
Thank you very much, ma'am. In terms of the independence of the Inspector General, I really believe that if we are serious about the effectiveness of the Inspector General's office, that independence is critical. And how this independence should be established or should be implemented is that firstly, as I have made an example with the ITC system, I think this is very important because the Inspector General cannot do his work or her work only based on whatever that he will be given. So the Inspector General needs to be able to retrieve documents at will. That is why the Inspector General has the top secret clearance. So nothing should bar the office from attaining those documents. So I do believe that without having that access, it's not going to go well. And my number two, I do believe that if you look at the budget of the Inspector General, I remember when I was in the ministry, the inspector came to see the minister, and one of the issues that the Inspector General raised was the issue of the budget, that the budget is actually within the SSA, and they are stifled. They are not able to do their work the way they do, because they are affected by whatever that the SSA gets affected with in terms of how the budget is supposed to be spent. So the Inspector General has to have their own budget so that at any time, whenever they want to disperse their functions, nothing should hamstring them. And I do believe also that in terms of unfortunately, when it comes to the clearance of the Inspector General, there is nothing we can do about it. I do agree that the Inspector General should undergo clearance, and unfortunately by the SSA, because the SSA holds the mandate within the country of counterintelligence, and vetting being a tool of counterintelligence, the Inspector General, even though independent, should be subjected by the SSA through the process of vetting. Yeah, I do believe that, yeah, I really agree with the independence of the Inspector General. What else did you ask, ma'am?
I wanted to hear your views, and also how are you going to ensure that the status is attained?
In terms of the status for independence, I do believe that the JSCI, being the committee that is actually the parliamentary oversight that is even able to hold the executive up to the president to account, stands as a responsible committee or a responsible body to assist the Inspector General after having put down a written proposal of these are the reasons why we believe that this office has to be independent. Now we believe that the JSCI can assist us in entering into discussions with the executive so that indeed the Inspector General's office can have this independence that we have. So I am not seeing any other way except through the JSCI advocating on behalf of the Inspector General.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think, am I still safe? Yes. Okay. So the IGI has, over a period of time, taken decisions and recommendations on a number of occasions through various mechanisms as provided for in the Intelligence Services Oversight Act. So if appointed, what would you do to enforce those recommendations, and why?
Thank you very much. The way the Oversight Act stands at the moment is that the Inspector General's report is only about recommendations right now. It's not to an extent that the recommendations can be enforced in any other way. But when I take over as the Inspector General, I will advocate for a situation, number one, of really including and engaging the JSCI, because again, the JSCI has those powers, and the JSCI will be able to hold the executive, which is the minister, to account about why the recommendations have not been implemented. And as I have said that, I do believe that the strong relationship building that I will embark on will cause a situation where the heads of the intelligence services will have to explain, now that you have not taken and to implement these recommendations, you need to come up with your own alternative then to say these recommendations were not good enough, you have good enough reason. Because the reason for the recommendation to be stipulated is because there is a problem that needs to be fixed. Now that the solution that you are given, you are rejecting, show us your own alternative. This is where the JSCI then will stand up to say, as an oversight body, we are not accepting this situation. My number two will be advocate for powers that will be similar to those of the public protector, to say these recommendations cannot just be recommendations. They have to be implemented because it will be counterproductive indeed if we are just going to over years to make recommendations without anything to come by that. And I do believe then that if the situation comes to waste, the courts of the land are there. Because we have to look into which area of our legislation has been violated here. Now, a person that will not be wanting to recommend this, to implement these things, they will have to be actually taken to an extent of the courts of the land.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Thanks, Ms. Lamine, for your responses.
Thank you. I think we will go this way.
Mixing it up, are we? Hello to you. Please explain to me, okay, first of all, the new CV and the old CV, I've scanned them through twice. I can't see any difference. Was there some material difference that you felt the need to send a new one in?
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, there is. There are two sentences that I have removed.
Okay.
Yeah, and those two sentences really have a direct impact on national security, safety, and all that.
Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
You were a special advisor to the minister during the July rioting, before the minister was removed, which is why I presume you're now unemployed. I take it the special advisor disappears with the minister. So were you the one who was advising the minister on how to handle the whole debacle of one minister throwing the other minister under the bus, etc.? Or did you perhaps advise the minister and she perhaps didn't take your advice? What was the situation there? Because it was certainly from the outside utterly chaotic.
Thank you, ma'am. During the issue of the July riots, the interaction of the minister and the other minister was away from the space that I was at. Because if we remember very well, is that even the JCI at that time did come to the premises to make their own inquiry into what happened. Because the fact of the matter is, even the report, as the report has also highlighted, the SSA did provide intelligence as to the quality, maybe that we can ask. But in terms of providing intelligence, that did happen. But in terms of the to and froing of the minister, and I do believe that indeed the minister, the former minister Ayanda Dlodlo, surely she had to stand up for the men and women of the SSA who have, despite a lack of capacity, even despite the fact of how that organization has been hollowed, but managed to pick up, even prior to the incident itself, as early as June, they kept on feeding the system with reports of early warning. Well, we can argue about, but the way the whole thing, you know, there was mass looting and so on and so on, as the JCI would be aware as well, yes, you cannot stop a spontaneity or a mob psych because you don't know how it will develop and so on. But in terms of early warning of the protest and so on and so on, even the report has highlighted that the SSA did provide. So you can imagine, ma'am, that you know that your people have really put whatever that they could in place for this to be reported, but at the end it's reported that you have done nothing. It couldn't. Thank you, ma'am.
If we could move on now to the actual job of the IGI, if you could spell out the functions that the president may, according to the legislation, designate to the IGI, and in which case, who would you give the report to the president or to this committee? And what do you believe are the IGI functions in terms of reporting to this committee?
Okay. The Oversight Act states that the functions that the IGI is given to perform, the IGI needs to report to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, but also it says that the IGI should report to the President. So now, in terms of where, because of course the IGN can be asked by the minister to do some task, he can also be asked by the President to do the stuff. So in terms of your question, ma'am, is that if the President gives the IGI work to do, now the IGI will have to report as well to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. I'm saying that because the IGI should be a body really that is impartial, that services this democracy. We have learned from the past in our recent history that actually the institutions of the state can be subverted and can be utilized for other agendas other than the agenda of national security. So the IGI is not in contrast with the law if the IGI would also report this to the committee. Because at the end of the day, even the executive is subject to parliamentary oversight. So for me, really, the IGI should also report this thing to the minister. To the JSCI. Now, the functions the functions that you asked about, ma'am, was the functions in relation to reporting to the President, not in general. So this is my answer.
If the Office of the IGI issues a recommendation, it seems currently that none of the ministers, none of the DGs are actually obliged to take on that recommendation and act on it. Now, what would your plan be to attempt to enforce or to ensure that those recommendations are enforced in the future?
Thank you, ma'am. I think, you know, what we are, the situation that we're in is that we really approach our work more on compliance rather than on fostering a culture where we understand each other's role, and we are actually persuaded by the organizational culture and the values that we have in why we do what we do. So for me, that relationship building that I was talking about will already lay a foundation for the recommendations of the IG to be implemented. Because, you know, when you approach the organization as the body that seeks to assist the body to be effective, to be functional, and to be successful, and you actually come with advices on how they can do this and how they can do that, I do not believe that when you have postured yourself in such a way as a person who is there to enhance the effectiveness of the organization, you are not going to be taken as somebody who's intruding. And as a result, I do believe that foundation that I am going to lay is going to make it easy for the recommendations of the IGI to be implemented. But of course, if now it goes beyond that and it is not happening, this is when I am going to rely to the JSCI.
Could you bring the report on such visits to the attention of the committee, whether or not it contained information which may not be...
All right. In terms of the IGI and the access to information, the IGI has no hindrance. He has an unfettered access to whatever, whether it's COVID, whether it's the IGI has access to that. But when it comes to the JSCI, there are limitations in as far as COVID information is concerned. So there's going to be that boundary when it comes to sharing this information with the JSCI. Yes, the context and other details will be there, but anything of COVID nature and anything that needs to be protected, even from the ears and eyes of the JSCI, that the IGI must do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. The Honourable, the good doctor.
Thank you very much. Qabani lika Thambo. Mkhondo madod. Madlamini.
I think you must be out of order. Hadebe with an H.
Profusely and sincerely apologize.
That's tautology. Thank you. The questions I have. Did you say that? I must ask this on the follow-up because I will have an opportunity. I forgot. When you worked at SARS, is this you 2008 to 2014? Were you working at SARS or were you working at the SSA managing SARS?
No, I left the SSA in 2008.
To
that
go work
period,
at SARS.
I was at SARS, yeah.
Okay. Do you remember how you got that job? Who interviewed you?
I was headhunted.
By who?
By Clifford Collins.
Clifford Collins. Clifford Collins is a former foreign branch intelligence official, no?
Yes.
Mm. Were you working in the... Did you work with Ivan Pillay?
No, Ivan Pillay was the... But he was at the level where Clifford was reporting to.
So Clifford was reporting to Ivan Pillay.
Yeah.
You were headhunted.
Yes.
Were there any covert intelligence collection activities in the unit you worked in?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge, because the anti-corruption and security was not permitted to can, nothing actually was for it to be involved in any COVID operations. Not that I know of. If there was, I am not aware of that.
So SARS employed you to do vetting, which normally should be done by SSA. Am I correct?
I can explain.
Yeah, of course, it's your chance.
I will not remember the year, I think it should be 2005, Parliament came with cabinet. There's a cabinet meeting, a minute, that established what we call field worker units. These field worker units are vetting capacities in Home Affairs, in SARS, in the Reserve Bank, in other government departments. So how they function is that the department that is outside the SSA or NIA, let us say SARS in this case, SARS will conduct field work, which is vetting, collect all the information and so on. When the file is complete, the file goes to the SSA, NIA at that time. The file will go to NIA. It's still happening even today. You have this field worker unit, as I was saying, in Reserve Bank, in SARS, in Home Affairs, and so on and so on. So my working there was based on that cabinet meeting minute that established these field worker units.
In vetting, is there no intrusive methods that are employed? I mean, vetting by nature, that's why it's an SSA, it's because it employs intrusive methods. Am I correct?
Not at all.
Okay.
The vetting does not employ intrusive methods because vetting is a counterintelligence tool. It's in the defense counterintelligence side. And it is not offensive, because when you start employing intrusive tools is when now you are embarking on the offensive side of counterintelligence, whereas vetting is in the defensive side.
Why didn't the minister take you along to, that's normally a practice, as a special advisor to the new department, public service?
Thank you, member. From the beginning, when the minister made this proposal to me that she wants me to be her special advisor, it was our agreement that I am coming on board to assist her in as far as core business at the SSA is concerned.
So meaning that
my being there, it's not because of her, but it's because of what I can bring to her. So when she goes to the public service, it is not aligned to where I wish to be. So that is why I didn't go in.
So there was this moment in which the minister did not oppose the rogue unit report from being set aside by a court. Do you recall that moment?
It will need me to really go back. Because, you see, I was advising the minister mostly when it comes to issues of core business. We had people who were legal advisors, especially from the SSA, that was working with the minister on these issues.
Okay.
Yeah.
My final question. Is it legal in our entire legal framework, particularly constitutionally, for organs of the state to establish intelligence units, whether these intelligence units are doing covert or non-covert activities, whether they are using intrusive methods or not, to have intelligence units without the permission of the president? Is it legal? One. Two, what kind of security threats would actually arise out of organs of state having security or intelligence units within themselves? Department of Education, Mayor of Polokwane, Mayor of Mkandule, and so on and so forth. What kind of security threats do you think that would pose to the country?
You know, member, you know, the National Strategic Intelligence Act talks about establishment of departmental intelligence. I think at this point in time, I remember that, you know, we're busy trying to get to an understanding exactly what it is that the National Strategic Intelligence Act says about establishment of departmental. It is in the Act, but your question is saying, is it legal to do that without the involvement or the okaying by the president? So I do believe that it can never be correct. It can never be correct to do that. I think the Act actually for now gives intelligence to the defense intelligence, to the civilian intelligence, and also to crime intelligence. But also it talks about that departmental intelligence. The departmental intelligence can never be established by a commissioner, for instance, or by the director general on their own without talking to the SSA, and also at the end the president actually approving on that. Otherwise, we will be a rogue state.
Can I read you Section 209 of the Constitution, subsection 1? Any intelligence service, and I repeat any, other than any intelligence division of the Defense Force or Police Service, may be established only by the President.
True.
As head of the National Executive, and only in terms of legislation. So it's not true, no, that the SSA can establish intelligence units outside of its immediate legislative scope.
If you heard me correct, honourable member, I did say in consultation with SSA, because SSA will only be assisting in terms of how this thing is supposed to work, but at the end the president is the one, I use the word okaying, is the president who is going to approve that, because the president is, the president has no, you know, as the Constitution says, it's the president who does that, but the expertise lies with the SSA, for instance, in this case. So that is why the SSA will be assisting in terms of the modalities, but at the end, the president is the one who approves. So it means the president has established.
My final question. You've been working with Minister Ayanda Zondo, who failed, in my view. You want to convince me, I'm one of the panel members. She failed with distinction.
Take in your time.
No, Chairperson, I'm indebted to you on this one. Should I?
1 minute, okay.
Okay, thank you. You worked with Minister Ayanda Zondo from when she was appointed to when she was, I think, dismissed from this position or exchanged. I think she failed with distinction, and I think the riots are a case in point. Why should we put you as the IGI? Don't you think that we will be exacerbating the lack of confidence that the institution, the entire intelligence community already lacks in the public eye? Just give us a chance to say, taking you from Ayanda, putting you, that will be direct from Ayanda to the IGI. You're not working since. Why should we do that? Wouldn't it damage the reputation of the intelligence services, the IGI, even further, and this failure that is a big reputational damage at the moment in front of our people?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think if you are going to judge my possibility of performing as an IGI based on the standards or the performance of Minister Zondo, actually it means I can get the job even tomorrow, because Minister Zondo has excelled. She has excelled in pursuing her responsibility as the Minister of Intelligence. I have seen the opposition she had to work under, how she was resisted, but still she managed to forge ahead and put in place so many things that when she came there were non-existent. And I do believe that even the issue right now as we speak, the high-level review panel came with a very important recommendation of saying the intelligence structure, the intelligence service, which is the SSA, needs to be disestablished so that we correct the ills that happened in the previous dispensation. And that, actually, the minister already established a task team which was able to consult over in a wide variety of platforms and put up produced a general intelligence amendment bill with proposals that, when actually implemented, those proposals are going to see a repositioned, a remodeled, an intelligence organization that is going to be so effective. We're not going to be experiencing these things that we're experiencing in the country, of our infrastructure being vandalized, which I call economic sabotage. We're not going to see all these situations of, organized crime that is ravaging our country. So I believe that indeed the minister, Ayanda Dlodlo, has really, there are so many things that she has actually put in place. And we should remember also that the period of time that she was there, the morale of the members were remarkably actually improved compared to what was before. So this is what I believe. Okay, I think I should proceed. Before I left there, because this is under the minister, as you have correctly pointed out, I have put in a proposal to change how vetting is supposed to be approached. We know very well that right now we have a serious problem of backlog of vetting across the board. You talk crime intelligence, you talk defense intelligence, you talk SSA. We have a serious problem of backlog. So I have come up with a proposal that shows that actually it is possible to eliminate this backlog. So the other thing as well that I can mention is that the minister came there and realized that in terms of deploying members to foreign stations, this is a contested terrain. This is what we read about every time in the newspapers. But the minister came up with an operational deployment strategy that is so fundamental in deploying our capabilities abroad in a way that is so logical, that is so effective. If implemented, we will see a turnaround into how effective the SSA is. That strategy, actually, the minister was at a point where the strategy is supposed to be again developed for the domestic branch, so that deploying our capabilities in provinces up to the level of the municipal level is supposed to happen. So there are all these strategies that are in place. I can talk of issues of the minister putting in place, because there's an outcry of the issues of sexual harassment within the SSA. The minister has put in place a task team, or a committee, if you like, of people that are going to be looking into these matters of sexual harassment, because right now this is an area where no one is talking about. It's been in the papers at some point, but no one is talking about those things. But the minister came in and put in place this structure there. The minister has made the issue of the appeal and adjudication board to be in place, so that every member in the organization that have appeals to make can bring those forward. And now you started to see the morale of the membership of the organization changing. I can count so many things that the minister has already put in place. She has put in place a task team again, which is under the Deputy Minister of Intelligence, Honorable Zizi Kodwa, to work on the implementation of the high-level review panel. And I do know, because I think I did have a sight limitedly of the report that they had produced. They have, really moved some level into ensuring that the recommendations of the high-level review panel are implemented. So there are so many things. The issue also, again, of launching the intelligence veteran structure, because this is according to the Intelligence Services Act and the intelligence regulations that say the intelligence structures, especially the SSA, need to have a relationship with the intelligence structures. I, for one, have made a benchmark study with the other intelligence organizations in the world to see how they utilize their intelligence veterans. And indeed, I found that all the intelligence organizations that I have benchmarked with do exactly use their intelligence veterans in their services, which is not happening here. But the minister was on the verge of launching that body so that it can work. Thank you very much, Honorable.
Thank you. Honorable Makwanisha, what was the other pronunciation? Makwanisha.
No, thank you very much, Chair. It's unfortunate that the Chair can't be called to order. No, thank you very much. Good day, Ms. Lamine.
Good day, Honorable Makwanisha.
Thank you. Just from your CV, you have trained in quite a number of countries, including Cuba, GDR. Just briefly, how long did you undergo training in each of those countries, briefly?
Thank you, Say. I think that is why even in my CV, I was careful to write I was trained by services of these countries. Because in terms of the training by Stasi of the GDR, German Democratic Republic, I was trained in GDR. The training was 6 months. And when I was trained by the ZCIO, the training was in Harare. The training was, I think it was for 3 months, because it was the time of, because I voted, when I cast my first vote, I was in Harare, actually. And when it comes to the CIA, this one was for a month. And when it comes to the Cuban one, it should be roughly 3 months as well. And the ones that I did internally, the operational course lasted for a year. And the executive national security program lasted for 6 months. And that one actually also included a study visit to France, where we were, you know, seeing how the French were approaching their own national security approach. Yeah. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. You said earlier on that the Inspector General of Intelligence approached the minister about issues relating to the budget of the IGI. What was your advice to the minister? Because you said that you are advising the minister on the core business.
Thank you, Honorable Member. I was in the meeting, but it was not my space there because we are two advisors. One is responsible for governance, and the other, which is me, is responsible for core business. So the budgetary stuff and all that will go to my other colleague. Thank you.
Okay. So what is the effect of Chapter 3 of the Constitution on the work of the IGI?
I want to believe that that part of the Constitution will talk about the fact that the IGI, as an oversight body, needs to be impartial, and they need to disperse their functions independently in order to satisfy the imperatives of national security. They have to do their work in a manner that is transparent. Also, even the candidate to be an inspector general should satisfy all those requirements.
Is Chapter 3 of the Constitution not about cooperative governance?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Then if I may have made a mistake. Yeah, Constitution is so long. So if it is about cooperative governance, in my view, it falls within the whole system of national security. I see it in the way that the office, the Inspector General himself, is a role player, a critical one, in this whole system of national security. While the intelligence structures or intelligence services are the instruments for national security. And then we know that also we have our different levels of government. So now the issue of cooperative governance there will go even to the heart of the relationships in terms of the issues of, you know, relating with the other oversight bodies as well, and relating as well with the Chapter 9 institutions, for instance, the Inspector General or the Inspector of the Police, the IPED, and so on and so on. This is how I think I will understand it.
No, thank you very much. According to you, are there any differences between the doctrine of state security and that of national security?
Thank you. I think if I can start with the doctrine of state security. You know, I think that let me approach it this way. Already the white paper on intelligence in the advent of democracy spelled out that our country is moving away from the state-centric national security, but now is adopting a people-centric national security. And it defines the issue that in the past, threats to national security were expected to come from neighboring countries in terms of their armies invading our country, which is why national security was about state security. But now, because we are in democracy, where our constitution in section 198 states that one of the fundamental principles of national security is our people having a resolve to live a life of harmony and peace, but very important, to experience a life that is free from fear and a life that is free from want. In this, therefore, it means national security that is people-centric is the one that does its business because it has the mind of the people and the heart of the people, and whatever that they do is to ensure that indeed what the Constitution says about the people, them experiencing a life free from fear and a life free from want, indeed happens. So this is a difference. With state security, you are not going to attain what the Constitution says. There's going to be a gap that forever is widening if you are going to have state security, whereas actually your country, your constitution calls upon you to be people-centric.
Did you at any point have a discussion with the minister with regard to that discussion? Because the name of the department still refers to as state security.
As I have pointed out that it was the minister's priority that this recommendation of the high-level review panel that says disestablish has to be done. So in that task team that I spoke about, that I was a coordinator of, that was charged by the minister of looking into the proposals of the new architecture of the intelligence organization. So the minister then, it means, have given a leeway to say, advise me, so that I advise the president and the policymaker of how intelligence is supposed to be. So one of the things, therefore, in this proposal that is put in place was that indeed there has to be a shift, a paradigm shift, to go back to a national security doctrine that is people-centric. There are definite proposals that we have put in place with my team to say this is how actually we can take away this focus of intelligence and give it this paradigm shift so that intelligence really can begin to do its job in a people-centric way of doing business in terms of national security.
Lastly, have you ever been in a situation where you had to take a decision or challenge authority at a great risk to your own sense of comfort?
Well, here I think I can make an example. I can make an example of, even though it is long ago, but I think it is important even still today. When I was still a section head of vetting in the South African Secret Service, at that point, our divisional head and the whole meeting actually came with a decision that all the members that come from non-statutory forces, which is those who come from the PAS, the Pan-Africanist Security Service of the PAC, and those that come from DIS of the ANC, are supposed to be vetted. And those that come from the statutory forces, which is the NIS and other homeland intelligence services, will not be vetted. They will only be vetted after 5 years. I had an issue with that. I challenged the meeting, I challenged my superiors to say that can never be correct, because the issue is that right now we are in the South African Secret Service. We're not in the DIS, we're not in the NIS, and we're not in the TIS or in the VINIS or wherever. This is the South African Secret Service, and everybody will have to start having their security clearance begin now. So this was a very serious challenge that I know that I was actually even risking. But I stood my ground, and because of my resilience into pursuing this matter, indeed, at the end, I got a buy-in, because I had to actually even report to the Director General that I do not agree with what this decision is about. And indeed, that was overruled, and the South African Secret Service started to... So I had a responsibility of doing a threat assessment that will inform the DG to say we can start vetting in that structure, that directorate, and so on. And then we began that for a very long time until I left SARS in 2008. There was never a backlog. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Kumede. Ms. Lamine, my apologies. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can we get to Honorable Stebe?
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Lamini, I just want to begin where my colleague next to me was asking about your time frame. You left the country in 1986, and you came back in 1993. That's what I could gather. Am I right there, according to your CV and the information in here?
Yeah.
Okay. Then you said, but in 1958, you were in Moscow.
Yes.
And then the next place that you were was in 1991 in Stockholm.
Yes, sir.
How long were you in Moscow, and how long were you in Stockholm? Mm.
In Moscow, I was there for a course that lasted for 10 months. So it will be, it either could be 87, then overlapped to 88. But I was in Moscow for 10 months for a political science qualification, which actually, by the way, now I have the certificate in hand because the minister has actually, you know, spoken to her counterparts in Russia, and they were able to, all the people, all the comrades who underwent training, be it intelligence or whatever, we have two boxes of a certificate. I have mine also for that 10 months. Thank you.
Okay, just to follow up there, that was for 10 months. Then from 88 till 91, there's nothing in your CV. What you were not in South Africa. Where did you work for in that period? From when you finished in Moscow until you started in Stockholm in 1991. Where were you? Were you working somewhere? Was it in Moscow or was it somewhere else in the world?
Okay. I can explain it this way to say my home was in Angola at that time. When I say I am going somewhere, I go wherever, but I come back to Angola. If not, if then I will be sent somewhere, I will be going to maybe Zambia, but my home was in Angola. So the back and forth would be between me and other countries, but with Angola. Because remember, honorable member, at that time I had left the country to join the ranks of Umkhonto weSizwe, and Umkhonto weSizwe was outside the country. So I am a commissar.
My good doctor, you are out of order.
Thank you. Okay, we can stop there. Then you said you had the vision right in the start. You said you recognize some entities. You said we have got the ailing organization, and your words was a sinking ship. Now, what strategy will you implement to stop that sinking ship? And what did you meant by saying it is a sinking ship?
You know, directly, without saying much, it's a sinking ship because there is no intelligence organization that can survive without an effective counterintelligence. Over years, the SSA has been functioning without an effective counterintelligence. You know, when you look at the National Strategic Intelligence Act, it is clearly stated there what the mandate of counterintelligence is, amongst which is the protection and the safeguarding of intelligence. And intelligence here is referred to the intelligence operations of the organization, but also the integrity of the intelligence product. If you look at the Act, you will see that intelligence as a mandate only has a mandate to collect, you know, the whole cycle of intelligence and take the product to the NICOG. That is what intelligence is supposed to do. Whereas counterintelligence is supposed to do all what intelligence does, but added to that, it's supposed to report to the president, to the Home Affairs Department, to the SAPS, to other departments of the state. And yet you do not have this capacity the way it is supposed to function at the SSA. Now the question is, then what strategies do I have? The strategy that I have is that you cannot have a counterintelligence that continues to be an appendage of intelligence, which means counterintelligence is supposed to be a standalone entity that reports to the president of the country, not to the DG. It is not supposed to be like that, because if counterintelligence reports to the DG is able to do whatever that he wants, with counterintelligence not effectively monitoring and picking up what the DG is doing. So subverting intelligence organization becomes very easy. Now the question may be, but the president is also a human being. The president can also do what the DG can do. So my response is that that is why in our country we have a parliamentary oversight, which is very powerful. The JSCI is very powerful because the counterintelligence, when they pick up that the president of the country is actually subverting the intelligence organization, the counterintelligence is able to report this to the JSCI, and the president will be held accountable. I do believe that really without having this effective standalone counterintelligence, we will say whatever that we'll say. We will not succeed. But my number two is that for a very long time, the intelligence structures, even including crime intelligence, even including defense intelligence, we are more focused on compliance. We're not talking about the issues of fixing the organizational culture and advocating for living the organizational values. So I want to believe that the intelligence structure, because I have also conducted a desktop research, and I have found out that even the CIA recommends that the intelligence structures should and cannot survive actually without having a capacity that is responsible for promoting integrity within the ranks of intelligence organizations. Number two, to have a pillar that will just focus on the compliance with policies. And also number three, to have a pillar that will disperse sanctions. Because the problem that we are seeing, Honorable Member, is that there is so much apathy in terms of dispersing the functions that are supposed to be done by intelligence, or even an apathy of taking people and holding them accountable for things that they are supposed to be doing and are not doing. And that has led to a culture of impunity. So people just conduct themselves in a way that, you know, raises an issue of security breaches and situations that are actually dragging the name of the organization to the mud, but nothing is happening. So I do believe that you have to have these three pillars, because with the promotion pillar, you are inculcating the values of the organization so that even the leadership know that being a leader means whatever that I do, my subordinates are actually emulating my behavior. Leadership of the organizations are the one that sets the ethical tone for the organization. If we're talking about crime intelligence, for instance, with a leadership that is in the papers for, you know, embezzling the slush fund, or that is the infighting is so rife and so on and so on, that culture that is set there, that tone that is set, is emulated by the members on the ground. Now you tell me, when is crime intelligence then is going to be able to run after, to detect where crime is so that they can give the information to the subs to deal with the high level of crimes in our country?
Chair? I've still got time.
No.
Okay, it's my follow-up. Thank you. First follow-up.
Thank you very much. From what you have just said, it's one question that I always ask. It's in the Oversight Act, Section 7. It says something about the IGI. If the IGI is given a task by the president, it must then report to the president. You have just mentioned something about if the president does something wrong, then they must report to, then counterintelligence can report to the JSCI. Do you think it's ideal for that type of a situation where the IGI will be given a task? My understanding is that the Inspector General is the operational part of this committee. So if they can be given some other task that we don't know about, don't you think that is dangerous? Especially because if you are given that task by a president, it's very difficult to say no. Very few people can say no when it comes to that. To think it's an ideal type of situation. I think you are provoking me all the time. And you seem to be succeeding. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I do believe in the power that the JCI has. There's a reason why there is this oversight body. It's to ensure that really there is no capture of the intelligence structures, that there is no subversion that happens, because all these things impact on national security. So the president has powers, indeed, the president has powers, but the powers of the president also are limited in terms of the parliament, the parliamentary oversight. So I do believe, indeed, that when the president will give a task to the intelligence, to the IGI, this is the question, to the IGI, the IGI will perform that task. When the IGI reports to the president, the IGI will also report that to the JSCI. I do believe that it should go that way. That is why I believe that we have a parliamentary oversight. Otherwise, it was just going to be an executive oversight only.
But that is not what the Act says. So you agree with me? Or there's something wrong with this?
I do agree, Chair. I think for me there is the spirit of the law and there is the letter of the law. The letter of the law may be as is, but the spirit of the law was that we want to have oversight, so that with oversight we know that there are no shenanigans that happens without that coming to light. That is the spirit of the law. So I do believe that if then the spirit of the law is not going to be promoted to that extent, the letter of the law needs to change then to reflect the spirit of the law in that regard, the way I see it.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mima.
Good afternoon, Madam.
Good afternoon, sir.
In your curriculum vitae, you make reference to you being part of the team of four that produced a draft General Intelligence Law Amendment Bill with proposal for future architecture of the civilian intelligence of the country. Can you just probably give us the attributes of this proposal, point of emphasis, the thrust of it? Thank you.
Thank you, sir. In terms of the proposals that we are putting in place, is that standalone, number one key, that standalone counterintelligence, as I have already explained, why it is that necessary to have it. And number two is the issue of collection. I think, you know, I want to expand, but I am cautious as well of not, you know, dabbling in areas that I should not go into, because we are in the public space right now. I'm not sure, Chairperson, how to... Because I was just about to really flow, and I realized that we are actually on the
public platform. Flow. Just pick on where I've got, assuming that I've got a deputy there. So.
I think just to maybe on top, you know, without getting into details, but the proposals have to do with really building capacity for intelligence collection at all levels. Because what we are realizing is that our municipal level, we don't have presence of counterintelligence. We don't have presence of intelligence. And this is at the heart of service delivery. This is where national security is experienced, where we are saying there is a gap between the aspirations that are expressed in the Constitution and the reality that is experienced by our people on a day-to-day basis. So how will this situation change when actually counterintelligence and intelligence are only at the provincial level, but they are not cascading to that level of service delivery? We are talking about issues that have to do with capacity in terms of collections abroad. We're talking about capacity in terms of inculcating this organizational culture that I was talking about, because without that organizational culture, you are not going to win. You can change the leadership of the organization how many times you want, as long as the culture remains that of syndicating and turning the organization into a personal purse and all those things. It's not gonna be possible. So there are other things as well, Honourable Member, that I may not ventilate.
Thank you, Ms. Amini. The second point relates to an area that is quite critical to our deliberations in assisting us to whether will you advance the office if appointed. It relates to the issue of stakeholder relations. From where you come from as a special advisor to the minister, what would your observation be in terms of the relation that existed between the IGI and the and Musanda?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think my own observation is that the relations, were not necessarily the way I would refer.
Some noise somewhere there. You are protected. You can continue.
The way I would prefer the office of the IGI to have relations with the services, because I believe that the relationship is supposed to be very dynamic. There has to be a continuous feedback. You see, I think if we're going to have a situation where the report will only come at the end of the year, based on what? Based on what the intelligence services are giving the IGI, and then the IGI makes a pronouncement, this is not fostering good relationship. So good relationship should be about a continuous engagement, a continuous fostering of this relationship, so that they also understand the role of the Inspector General as part and parcel of this national security infrastructure or system that we have. So I do not believe and I do not think that the relationship with the IGI, indeed the IGI's role for me, the way I see it, was seen of course as this, you know, okay. But I don't think actually it was the way it is supposed to be. Not by doing.
You can say it is important for you to tell us, or how was it seen?
And this is my own perception. And the people who, the Inspector General may differ with me, it's my own observation. And it is based on the fact that, for me, I believe that an Inspector General has to have this dynamic communication and a dynamic contact with the services, not just based on, you have done wrong, now I come for you. That already creates tensions. But if it's a situation of, why in this together, my role is this, yours is this, so let us see how we're going to do this, so that at the end we are able to come up with something that is going to make this organization work better. That is why I spoke about the Inspector General being proactive. That's very important. But that dynamic communication and contact at any time, as I was saying, quarterly, and at any time as it can be necessary, will improve things in terms of relationship.
This
1 minute.
This relation, did it fall under your core business, or it was the relation between the SSA and the IGI? Did it fall under your competency or under your colleague? I'm raising this point given the fact that it can't just be the IGI should have been proactive. It's a two-way process. And given the magnitude of the department and the presence of the executing authority, don't you think that as a special advisor, you should have advised the minister to also be proactive from her side?
Well, my involvement with the IGI were to make inputs in as far as the findings of core business for the SSA were involved. So this is where my advising was about. Core business in terms of core business of the SSA, what are the findings and what are the recommendations? So, Minister, these are the things, and actually I do agree with this, and this one, indeed, the SSA need to do this and that and that. This is how, actually, it was laid out.
I'll come back under follow-up, Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Megamin.
I'm not sure about that.
They come back.
Okay, Honorable Hadebe with an H.
No, thanks, Chair. I'm also not sure. There's no comeback, Chief. Has no comeback. No, that was just on a lighter note, Chair. Sibalukhulu Mkhonto, part of our assessment has to do, well, I'm sure you are aware, because it was part of the advert, that we're looking for a citizen that is fit and proper. Now, the fit and proper aspect speaks to honesty, integrity, and impartiality. Now, I'm raising this mindful of the fact that Section 18 of our Constitution promotes freedom of association, and Section 19 guarantees the political right. As such, as this committee, we cannot prejudice you based on your political affiliation. However, based on the findings and recommendation on the high-level review panel report that there was politicization and factionalism within the agency, please tell us, how did you manage to insulate yourself, and how are you going to insulate yourself should we consider you as a candidate? So that once pretend twice shy, I'm sure you are aware of that. We don't want to exacerbate the problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. In this instant, in terms of your question, yes, I think let me just trace it to say, in 1994, when we started now to work for the country as intelligence officers, the induction that we got was that when you are an intelligence officer, your political activism go in as far as you vote for whatever party of your choice. You cannot be seen to be so political in a manner that actually you carry out the whatever aspirations of your political party within this setup. Because here you are serving the people of South Africa. That is your number one. Your number one is allegiance to the Constitution and allegiance to the people of South Africa. That I have carried through my career. And actually, for that matter, even before I joined the statutory intelligence organization, even within the ranks of MK, after having completed a task as a platoon, the commander would say, when we are standing there in attention, he would say, "Who do you serve, comrades?" We will respond and say, "We serve the people of South Africa." As I have said, we were in Angola. The people of South Africa were not in Angola. But it was inculcated within us that whatever you do it for the people of South Africa. Over and above that, the law is clear, as you have quoted it. But I wanted to show you that this is not even about complying with the legislation, but it's about your convictions and your values and your principles.
Thank you, Commissar. Now,
can I, before you get in,
okay,
start there with an H.
As the chair pleases.
And what about this committee?
What about it, chair?
In terms of political or whatever and so on, this one, what do you think must happen?
Well,
what you have just explained.
Well, I do know that the committee is composed of members of different political parties. But the members of different political parties have sworn allegiance to the Constitution, even though they are here so that they represent their political parties. But number one, before their political parties, it is the Constitution of this country. So they will not come in this committee to just further the aims of their political party over the aspirations of the Constitution.
Are you sure about that?
I am 100% sure, Chase.
Okay. Thank you. You can continue, Hadebe, with an H.
Thank you, Honorable the Chairperson. From your opening remarks, you said, as outlined in the high-level review panel report, the agency is an ailing organization. You went further to say we are in a sinking ship, meaning as currently things stand, we are in a Titanic. Yes, it's a Titanic. Sooner or later, we'll be sinking. You further said we need to have capacity for threats and risk assessment and identify areas of focus with intelligence aid. And you stated that we can't do this without strong capabilities of counterintelligence. Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
Yes. And looking at your role for the past 2 years, you said you were a special advisor to the minister in your core business of intelligence and counterintelligence. Do you think 2 years it's... okay, differently put, do you think there's a lot that can be achieved within 2 years?
I think so.
Okay. With what you have just told us and what I've just repeated to you, what have stopped you from implementing this as a special advisor to the minister? And if there were bottlenecks or challenges, what were those? I'm asking this precisely because now you're applying to be an inspector general. You will be expected to monitor and review activities of intelligence and counterintelligence. So the expectation is that that which you are speaking about now could have been implemented within that two-year period, and correctly agreed with me that there's a lot that can be achieved within the 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Member. I think to respond quickly is to say, yes, indeed, I was a special advisor, not implementer, meaning my role would go in as far as to say, this is what I believe needs to be done. But I am not the one charged with the responsibility to run this thing. But in my 2 years, of course, I have forwarded advice and proposals, you know, large and small. And I have already counted, for instance, the massive one, that proposal of this establishing the intelligence organization, that also goes with reviewing the whole law for intelligence, that general intelligence laws amendment bill. But on top of that, I have also been from the ministry side. I have been involved in matters of creating or drafting a national security strategy and also a national security policy. Even though this one was actually led by the colleagues that are at NICOG, but from the ministry side, I was involved with that process. I can actually even expatiate, you know, why this is big. I think it's important actually to outline why I am raising this, that even in these 2 years. Because you see, if our country can adopt this national security policy, the impact is not just going to be for the intelligence services. It's not just going to be for the government departments. It's going to be for the whole country. These issues of all these national security threats that we are experiencing. I will always talk about the sabotage of the railway lines. You talk about organized crimes, even at the mining areas, the Zamazamas. You talk about cash in transit heists. All these issues will be so minimized to a point that it will be worth reporting when they happen, because it is odd now. That national security policy will get us to that point. Now, what is most important also about the implementation of this national security policy, I need to make a quick comment to say the minister, which is one of the issues that Honorable Ndlozi was asking, to say the minister has not succeeded, and I said she actually has, excellently for that, is that it is under her reign that this issue, for the first time after 2013, I think, the national security strategy has been drafted, and also the national security policy has been drafted. And the view, and let me tell you, on the night, for that matter, of the reshuffle, the minister had already assembled a team that is even composed of academics and other levels of the society to engage. Because with the national security policy, it's not just the work of intelligence, but it is a work that involves all the strata of the society. And this is so important because it will go to a point where there will be what we will term as a national security indaba. This is where you involve the people of this country to come forward with solutions to the national challenges that they face. Because people have solutions, but we do not actually work with people so that they can come with these solutions. That consultation with the people will also foster this value that we lack in our country, the value of patriotism. Because with the value of patriotism, people will appreciate that their role in the whole system of national security go in as far as them protecting their infrastructure, because that assists them. It goes in as far as them reporting when they see wrongdoing. And in that way, again, it will ensure that indeed people embrace what the government is trying to put in place. So all these things happened during my time and during also the time of the minister. So another thing also that I want to point out is that this issue, it is very important. This issue of the operational deployment strategy that I cannot be able to, you know, talk the details of. The minister signed that strategy. That's a big achievement, because with that strategy, you actually have an organization.
Just a minute.
Just on a point of order. We are talking now issues that directly relate to the State Security Agency. We are here to talk about the Inspector General and what must transpire there. And I think if we go, because all that was said this morning is in relation to the State Security. And I feel that we must just come back to the Inspector General's office. Thank you.
Yeah, I think then the best thing to do that is for our questions to be directed that way, because if this I can't determine the questions that will be asked. So I think Honorable Hadebe, with an H, I think maybe we can let the finish what she was saying, and your time is over already.
Let us also be mindful of the fact that powers and functions of the Inspector General is to monitor and review activities of intelligence and counterintelligence. So they are interlinked. There is no way that you can separate unless I'm swimming in the river of confusion.
No, you see, I think I get what Honorable Stebe is saying. Not that they don't interlink, but now it seems I agree with him, or now we are dealing with SSA specifically, and maybe even what the minister did. And it becomes specific. But let me Ms. Dlamini finish on that one. All I can do is to caution, because I don't know whatever question is going to come from there. Over to you. You can finish. Honorable Hadebe's question.
Thank you.
And then even his time has lapsed.
I will quickly, in my understanding of the function that says monitor compliance with policies, this is a function of the Inspector General. And the already it is stated in the white paper on intelligence, this issue of national security policy. It's already stated in the high-level review panel. And the IG is supposed to ensure that these things are happening. So I did not see any were talking about the SSA. Maybe it's because Honorable Hadebe mentioned the name of the minister. Maybe this is where. Yeah, but the question, this is how I understood it.
Yeah, I
thank you, Sibalukhulu.
I should think if Hadebe, you went at length trying to...
Can I conclude?
No, you can't. Honorable Madikhali?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and my apology for the noise. I was not eating. I was trying to put everything in order on my table because Honorable Ndlozi said I'm eating. I was eating. I was not. Thank you very much, Sis Nomsa. Madlamini, thank you so much. This commission
knows. I say we are left with your only 10 minutes. We are not going to have any follow ups unless we agree. Your only 10 minutes is what we have left here.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Madlamini, this office is going to deal with submissions whereby others will submit anonymously. So I want to check with you as to how will you then satisfy the two parties, the one who submitted and the one maybe that the name or his or her name will be appearing in that submission. I'm asking this question because there's an incident whereby I've noticed that things were not in order in the office of the IGI. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. I do believe that all the submissions that will come should be treated with the highest confidentiality that they deserve, because obviously to be involved in a situation where you are going to be submitting this, you are already putting your life at risk, either from being ostracized by your leadership or actually where you are victimized and up to a point where your life is threatened. So there has to be that discreetness in the office of the IG. So that is why the Act is talking about that impartiality, that independence, and that is why also members of the IGI office are supposed to be vetted to the level of top secret.
Thank you very much for your response. And now I'm going to be specific on this one. If I cannot ask you this question, all the accolades maybe that I'll be having over your good work that you've been doing since this morning, I won't forgive myself. I see that there was a judgment in civil claim that has been made against you. And it looks like you are shifting the blame to somebody. I don't know whether the marriage was in community of property or out of community of property. If it was in community of property, why are you then writing only your name and not both names? And then if ever it happened that you win this position, how are you then going to change? Because this thing is tainting you and I don't think it's good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, this thing really hurts me because people who know me, I'm in public right now, people who know me that when it comes to issues of finances, actually I advise people on how they should handle their finances. This is how I am. So that blot is something that, as I have written there, I will not go on details about it. I will not go there, but I took my own money to try to settle this thing, even though it is not me, because really it is a plot that really hurts me and does not belong to me. I repudiate it with all the contempt. It's just unfortunate that I cannot talk about it now. It's settled, as I am saying there. But the fact that my name appears like that, it's not me. It's unlike me. That is just out of, yeah.
Yeah, that is why I'm worried. You know, one day, God will protect you. And all of us, the females. Oh.
The question is, all of us.
Oh, okay. Well, there's no problem. Now, going back to the office that you are contesting for, the invitation here is to make sure that the IGI has a greater autonomy. There is an urgent need for a legislative review of the functioning and resources of office of the IGI. The current configuration being resourced through SSA has demonstrated that it will be weakened and it will lead to the politicization of the SSA. Logically, who would fund and adequately resource an office designed to hold them accountable? Do you think that the office will function better if the IGI had a deputy to assist him or her in terms of law? I'm saying him or her because I don't know who is going to end up occupying this position. Thank you.
Honorable Member, I really believe that that would be of great assistance because I see the function of the IGI really broadening to how it is right now. Just to make an example, I do believe that, you know, the Oversight Act, for instance, in actually agreeing with the position that you are advancing, the Oversight Act only talks about the Inspector General having a purview over crime intelligence, SSA, NDI. Yet, actually, for instance, there are committees that produce intelligence. Talk NICOC, for instance. The IGI is not having any oversight over NICOC, over net joint, over even the counterintelligence coordinating forum. These are committees that produce intelligence. When you think about the issues of politicization of intelligence, this is through an intelligence product as well, but the IGI has no purview over that. You talk about areas like the Financial Intelligence Center. These generate intelligence. The IG has no purview over that. So this scope is broadening for one person. You go also over that, you realize the intense and the deep challenge that intelligence services are at. I'm talking about the three of them. We are in the process of rebuilding, I want to believe. We want to reposition and remodel. So it will need the intelligence inspector general also to change a paradigm on how we look at these things. So it will not just only be based on complaints, because right now, most of the work that the Inspector General is doing is based on complaints, and then it becomes the certification program. But as I have said even in the beginning, this is about changing the way we do things so that we can become proactive. We do those threats and risk assessments. We develop that case management system. We develop that communication feedback strategy so that we can. So this thing is broadening, and I want to actually agree with the advancement of having a deputy in the office.
Thank you, Ms. Nomsa. Going back to the high-level panel report. The high-level panel report or report panel found that the office of the IGI should be given some legislated status. In your opinion, based on the study of the current legislative framework, what legislative amendments are required for this office of the IGI? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that one that you spoke about the powers, because we are saying it's just recommendations, who cares, you know? So let the powers of the IGI be legislated. My number two about the amendments, it's that issue of also having a purview over the other intelligence generating, whether committees or departments. As well, I think for now, in terms of legislation, these are the two things that I would recommend.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm done, and I'm happy that Sis Nomsa is a woman. The way you handled my questions, it was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think Honorable Madi Lady Khalima Zen to volunteer information that was never asked for. I think we don't have, unless if we decide, we don't have time for. So I already have five people that says we don't have. So I would ask Ms. Lamini, it's now your chance.
So, sorry, Chairperson, I raised my hand. I didn't speak without your permission, but it looks like you are ignoring me.
I was on the point of whether we are going to be having follow-ups, and I said we don't have time.
No, I raised my hand, but you didn't point me.
Okay. So what is it in relation to?
It's in relation to this important matter of follow-ups.
No, I do have a follow-up. I said we've got five people who say no follow-ups, so it means that one is closed. I mean, you can't have a follow-up alone after it has been voted for.
But you didn't open the vote. Chair, don't chair badly.
No. Can I?
Maybe you might be tired, but you mustn't bully us.
No.
You mustn't bully us. We agreed on the structure of the interview.
Can I see?
Yeah, but don't dismiss me like that and say there was a vote. You didn't even open for a vote. You opened the question, I raised my hand, you don't point at me, and then you now want to bulldoze me.
I wonder what you expect me to do.
To recognize me.
No, I don't.
On a point of order, Chief.
Amar, it's unfair, Chairperson.
Can I give to... Ms. Lamini, as we close, it's your chance now. Do you have anything to say about the whole process? Any comments or whatever you would like to tell the panel about
Chair,
the
will you take my point of order after she would have been done?
Correct, I'll do that.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. What I'd like to say is really to express my gratitude for the opportunity that the JSCI has afforded me to come and be interviewed for this position. I do believe that the interviews went very well in terms of how I was engaged. So I really want to say thank you. That is what I'd say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and you can be released. Your point of order, Honorable Madi Khali.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Kivexana Gore Rejogamoro Hupishagile, because you asked a question and we responded. And thereafter, Honorable Ndlozi raised his hand.
Can you give her a chance to say whatever she wants to say? Can you give her a chance to say what she wants to say? I mean, those according to the rules of meetings, you know yourself, we don't do meetings that way. She's still on the floor.
I wanted to clarify that, but then he is saying I did not see him. But I'm seated like this, and I see both sides. Oh, okay, so... That's what I wanted to say, Chair, that you were not being unfair. You were fair in your ruling. Maybe next time, Honorable Ndlozi will raise his hand before we respond. Thank you.
Honorable, did you raise before? And then you will follow. Honorable Zagud and Honorable Moima.
Yes, the only challenge that I have for the approach is that it can open up open up this process to attack, in the sense that with all the candidates there has been follow-ups, and where there's reason to believe on the appearance that there was inconsistency, this process can be tainted. I was just questioning the meetings to the extent that consistency must be the overriding factor in terms of how we move forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. I just want to agree with what Honorable Maimang said just now, and also to propose that, Chairperson, maybe for us to be able to manage our time correctly, we can add 1 minute to the 10 minutes and use that 11 minutes fruitfully for both the questions and follow-ups. If we can do that, because we are trying to manage time so that we don't finish midnight today. Thanks, Chair.
You see, the problem is not the management of time. The problem is with the responses. It's very difficult for the chairperson to stop the responses from the candidate. It's easier to manage the colleagues, but very difficult to say when she's still explaining to say. That's why I can simply say 2 minutes just to highlight, but you can't say no, now your 2 minutes is finished. I can do that maybe with the colleagues. But anyway, even if we add, we make it 11, the situation is going to be the same. But I gave a warning that the way it goes, Madhya Khali, the 10 minutes that you are going to use would be the last one. Okay. Unless if you give me the go-ahead that then we extend. That's why I asked her, do we get in there or whatever? Can we go that way, Honorable Stephen, Honorable
Thank you, Chair. I think if we get another candidate that is not talking to the topic, not talking to the IGI, but elaborate on the experience and what is envisaged in the SS. A, and that's got nothing to do with I. You should call that 1 minute much earlier. Please.
Yes.
Even if it's going to be very difficult, because I wouldn't be the one that asks the question. If you ask the question about something that has got nothing to do with the IGI, it would be us who asked that question, and I can't get into it. Oh, Gwanise.
Thank you very much. Chair, the first point, I think what Honorable Maimane raised is important.
Are we on air?
No.
Yes. Oh.
What Honorable Maimane raised, I think it's important. This is not a portfolio committee meeting. It's a panel. And we must always bear that thing in mind. And as a result, whatever we do is open to legal challenges. So the first thing, I think it's always important to say to, if it's me who's going to be asking questions, you say it upfront, you have 10 minutes. Which means it's my duty to manage myself and the candidate. Now, when members ask a question for 2 minutes, and then the candidate will respond for 5 minutes. So how we often do it is that we give the budget to the member, which is 10 minutes, and the chair becomes strict on the time. If the time is up, the time is up. I think that is the first thing. Then the procedural one is the issue. I think we have agreed when we started that there is going to be follow-up. So let's try to have consensus. If there is any member who's got a follow-up within the given time of 20 minutes that the chair has always agreed to, I think it was the member has got rights, the candidate has got rights. So to manage all those loopholes of a possible litigation. But I do would like to appeal to all of us that let's ensure that we don't fight amongst ourselves in front of candidates. Let's maintain a certain high level of decorum for because this is an interviewing panel. Thank you, Chair.
Hadebe with an H.
No, thanks, Chair. I fully concur with the latter speaker. But also to add over and above the 10 minutes allocated to each of us to ask questions and follow-ups that have been agreed upon. We also agreed, Chair, that each candidate has got 2 hours. Now, when that 2 hours lapsed and we have not asked follow-up questions, it therefore becomes unfair to extend the 2 hours. The reason why we said there's no follow-up, it was on the basis that the 2 hours has lapsed. So let us take in consideration all aspects, including the 2 hour, so that we are fair to all other candidates that appeared before us. Some of us could not ask follow-up because the 2 hours has lapsed. Mm-hmm. So it's not an open-ended process. We need to take all those aspects into account. And the agreement of saying no follow-up was purely based on the time that has lapsed, which is 2 hours, which we've all agreed. Thank you, Chair.
The meeting's then adjourned. I think lunch is ready.